I'm Lipo Yu from NIAMS and a member of the Motility Interest Group. It is with great pleasure to welcome Dr. Clara Franzini Armstrong of UPenn to talk to us about her work on the mechanism of excitation contraction mechanism in muscles. I think it's not over-exaggerating to say that with her ultrastructure studies, Dr. Franzini Armstrong almost single-handedly led to our current understanding about the molecular mechanism of EC coupling in all types of muscle cells. In 1970s, she was the first one to visualize clearly there was a molecular component in the junctional gap between the transverse tubules and the sarcolemmic reticulum in muscle cells. And she recognized that at that time that this molecular component, and she called the feet, could play critical role in transforming or converting the action potential signals carried by the transverse tubules to initiate calcium release from SR, which would lead to calcium contraction. So since then, she has systematically studied the functions and some of these receptors and find out the roles that they play in the pathway of the EC coupling. Dr. Franzini Armstrong received her PhD from the University of Pisa in Italy. And she did postdoctoral work in three well-known labs at the time. The first one was in the lab of Keith Porter, and then in the lab of Richard Podolsky, in the laboratory of physical biology of NIAMD, at that time was in building two. And then she did work in the lab of Sandro Huxley, a University of College in London. And since 1981, she's been full professor at the Department of Cell Developmental Biology at UPenn Medical School. And she has received, of course, many honors and awards. Among them, she was elected a member of the National Academy of Sciences in 1995. And she's also a former member of the Royal Society of London. And most recently, she was elected a founder member of the Biophysical Society. And today, her talk, the title of her talk is Protein Interactions in Calcium Release Units of Skeletal and Cardiomuscle Cells. And Clara.
My voice does not carry very well, so please let me know if you don't hear too well. I thank you, Lipo, for the introduction. It reminds me of the time when I was here at NIH. It was a long time ago in Richard Podolsky's lab, and Lipo followed me afterwards. And in Richard's lab is where I started learning that in addition to structure, one ought to think about physiology when thinking about muscle. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to present my work, which is descriptive and structural, and use it to explain physiology. And mind you, what I'm going to do is an extremely oversimplified description of what happens when muscle gets activated. And this oversimplification is due to the fact that I will rely on the proteins that I can see in the electron microscope, and many others, of course, are present. But the ones that one sees in the electron microscope tell a very specific, a very interesting story. So that's what I will develop. So I'll start with a typical textbook image of a sketch of what is in a muscle fiber, and this is a skeletal muscle fiber. And of importance to us is the fact that there is an external membrane which invaginates into tubules, which are called the transverse tubules, and because these are continuous with each other, then the electrical impulse and the surface membrane travels along the transverse tubules and penetrates across the entire cross-section of the fiber. Inside the fiber, there is a separate system of membranes, which is called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it is the work of Anne-Marie Weber and Setsuo Ibashi, and also the work of Richard Podolsky, that demonstrated that this sarcoplasmic reticulum acts as a calcium sink. It holds calcium. It actually actively pumps it away from the myofibrils, and that results in relaxation. And when the muscle is activated, the calcium has to be released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum to initiate activation and contraction. And so, obviously, what happens is that then the central question in excitation-contraction couplings becomes the question of how a depolarization of the transverse tubules results in release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which requires an interaction between two separate membranes. The two membranes are not continuous with each other, but they are adjacent to each other in structures which are called triads. Two sarcoplasmic reticulum and one transverse tubule. And then in other muscles, instead of having a triad, you have different geometries, and so I got to call these calcium release units. And calcium release units are places where the sarcoplasmic reticulum makes an intimate association with either the transverse tubules or sometimes directly with the surface membrane. And these are sites where there is transmission of information between the two separate sets of membranes, one surface membrane and one internal. So the first thing that you see, that I'm talking about, are the two key molecules that can be seen in electron microscopy. And the first one, as Lippo defined, is the fact that you can see in the gap between transverse tubule and sarcoplasmic reticulum some very large structures, which I call the feet, because the sarcoplasmic reticulum looks like a caterpillar that walks on the transverse tubules, as a matter of fact. And the feet are large structure which connect directly the membrane. This is a transverse tubule here. Its membrane here and here. It's connected directly to the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum by the feet. Okay, so that was the first description. Another thing that you see, and I'll talk about later, is the fact that in the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, there is a visible meshwork of proteins, which was later identified as calsequestrin, a calcium-binding protein, and I will talk about that at the end of the talk. So here are the feet. Now, if we homogenize the muscle and isolate the sarcoplasmic reticulum vesicle with the feet attached, we see what's shown up here. You see two rows of structures, and each structure is a tetramer with four equal subunits, and they associate in a specific way, forming that row that was visible in thin sections. So the feet are actually tetramers. And it turns out, in a very exciting period of time in the 1980s, that when the biochemists, and there were two different laboratories that did that, isolated a very large protein, which was called at that time the ryanodine receptor, because it had a high affinity for ryanodine, for reasons that nobody ever knew, knew because they don't see ryanodine ever normally. But anyway, ryanodine receptors are molecules that were defined as being channels, that are channels that belong to the sarcoplasmic reticulum and that allow calcium to exit from the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the cytoplasm. And these are isolated ryanodine receptors from the laboratory of Kevin Campbell, one of the three laboratories that isolated that image in the electron microscope. You can now see the four subunits, which are the four subunits that you see here, or the feet in situ. So the feet are actually the cytoplasmic domains of this channel. And then in addition to that, there is a bump here, which is in this reconstruction of the structure, which is done by, again, several laboratories, Sergey Shevardnadze et al. wagonette hull, you see that there is a component of this channel, which is the component that's normally inside the membrane. That's the channel itself, and then a very large cytoplasmic domain, which is what you see in that image. And if you go back here, the important fact at that point was that immediately one knew that the channel that was a calcium channel that had a very high permeability for calcium was located in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, just where the sarcoplasmic reticulum is abutting against the transverse tubules. So that was a very exciting time. And so the possibility then of an interaction between the two membranes became very physically defined at that point. It was a matter of now asking how the transverse tubule membrane talked to this calcium release channel, which is touching it. Okay, so now the next question is, what do we have in the transverse tubule that could account for that behavior? And a further demonstration that the ryanodine receptor and the feet are the same thing. Here are young developing muscle cells in a normal mouse and in mouse that was mutated so that it was not expressed in the skeletal type of ryanodine receptor, which is the type 1. And you can see that here are the feet and here the feet are missing. The triads are still formed. The feet don't have to do with forming the triad. They have to do with the release of calcium. So normally calcium releases out to the feet. If we do a Friis fracture that involves the transverse tubule membrane, and in the Friis fracture the membrane is split, and the position of proteins in the membrane is revealed because they appear as little protruding particles. So here is a Friis fracture of a muscle that has very flat myofibrils and lots of transverse tubules. So these are all the transverse tubules, and you can see two leaflets, this leaflet and that leaflet, because the membrane is split into two leaflets. And we can now look at what we see about the proteins that occupy this membrane. And here's what we see, that within that membrane, you have groups of four particles that at that time we called tetrads. And what we start seeing is that the four particles are disposed at periodic distances. One group here, not very complete, missing place, another group, missing place, another group. And if we measure that distance, it comes out to be exactly twice the distance between the feet. So if we superimpose the two images, which are obtained in different preparations, but an image of the isolated sarcoplasmic reticulum with the feet and an image of the fractured transverse tubules with the tetrads on top of each other, we see that each tetrad is actually positioned quite precisely over the profile of the foot, but it has a slightly different twist to it, so that we can actually model this in this way. We made an array of feet using the high-resolution images from either Sereshevo wagonette, which are very, very similar to each other, and using the disposition that we had deducted from the shadowed images. And then on that, we superimposed by transparency an image of the four components of the tetrads. This time each tetrad is represented by a little circle of shadow. And you can see how the tetrad fits very nicely in a very specific position relative to the ryanodine receptor. You can ask, as most people do, what happens, couldn't you have, and then why the ryanodine receptor is missing it? So it's an alternate feet. And you can ask, well, why can't you just put them in the middle between the feet and have them shared? Well, it does not work out because then you lose the symmetry of the system. So the system has a symmetry if you superimpose the tetrads in this particular way. Now we have a prediction of what the position of these particles is relative to the ryanodine receptor. I have not told you what the particles are. Well, at the time when these particles were being discovered, structurally, the physiologist had observed that there is a so-called charge movement that he can detect electrically the fact that when you depolarize the membrane, there is a proton in that membrane that responds with a change in configuration such that you measure an extra flow of current. And that extra flow of current, of course, the voltages which are critical for excitation-contraction coupling. So it was proposed that there's a voltage sensor in the membrane. And then about 1987, Eduardo Rios first proposed it, and then Kurt Beam fully demonstrated that the protein that detects the voltage change is a type of calcium channel of the transverse tubule, which came to be called the dihydropyridine receptor, or DHPR, because it's affected by dihydropyridines. So we now have a channel in the transverse tubules that senses the voltage change, and presumably this sensing of the voltage change initiates a series of events that then gets transmitted to the sarcoplasmic reticulum so that the ryanodine receptor releases calcium. So what's the relationship between that and the tetra? That got solved by the observation that we did together with Kurt Beam, that in a muscle that has a null mutation for the dihydropyridine receptor, the tetras are missing. And if you culture cells that transfer them with the cDNA for the dihydropyridine receptor, the tetras reappear. So here we are. We have then defined the second molecular component of this junction. It's a calcium channel that senses the voltage and somehow transmits information to the ryanodine receptor. And the two are in a very specific relative position relative to each other. So now, this is the story in skeletal muscle. Let's look at what nature tells us a bit further, and then we go back to the function again. Nature has provided us with some interesting things, because it has provided two mechanisms of excitation-contraction coupling. One is the one that you find in skeletal muscle. When you depolarize, the voltage sensing by the dihydropyridine receptor affects the release of calcium from the ryanodine receptor independently of whether the dihydropyridine receptor, which is a calcium channel, carries a calcium current. So EC coupling can occur in the absolute absence of extracellular calcium. And this was actually first demonstrated by Clay Armstrong, I should say, my other half, in 1971. In invertebrate muscles and in the cardiac muscle of vertebrates, the situation is different. It's always been known that you need extracellular calcium to activate cardiac muscle ever since Ringer's experiment. Ringer needed to have calcium for cardiac muscle to be active, and then more specific recent experiments have demonstrated that very clearly. So you have to have calcium permeation through the dihydropyridine receptors of cardiac and invertebrate muscle in order for excitation-contraction coupling to occur. Okay, let's start with that premise and see what nature tells us about the structure. But one more detail. Let's go to the function directly. Here's a demonstration in the work of Kurt Beam of what I just said. If you depolarize a cardiac muscle cell, the calcium current carried by the dihydropyridine receptor is large and it turns on very rapidly. If you measure the calcium release with a calcium indicator in the cell, you see a calcium response in the presence of extracellular calcium. But if you have no extracellular calcium, there is no calcium release. And even this calcium current is so little that you don't see a signal. So this is a demonstration that you need calcium permeation to the dihydropyridine receptor to release calcium. In skeletal muscle, the dihydropyridine receptor really those are sluggish. They have very low open probability, so their current is very little. And they do produce an internal release. But even in the absence of extracellular calcium, so this current would be zero, you still get an intracellular release. Okay, so what does that show? Let's go back for a moment to the structure. In skeletal muscle, we have a ryanodine receptor in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. This is the channel component, this is the cytoplasmic component, and the cytoplasmic component is basically in touch with a tetrad of dihydropyridine receptors. And this is the same geometry, the different type of junction, which is found in some developing muscle cells. Now we go to cardiac muscle. Cardiac muscle, you have this situation with the sarcoplasmic reticulum, with feet associated with the surface membrane, and that part looks just like skeletal muscle. But when you do a freeze fracture of that membrane, you see the particles represent the dihydropyridine receptor, but you cannot see any tetrads there. And let's look at an insect muscle, and this is one of my favorites, a dragonfly, which I captured in the ponds in Woods Hole. And the dragonfly is a very fast-beating muscle with the most beautiful geometry. You have lots of mitochondria, very active muscle. Here are the dyads, and if you look at it, you see sarcoplasmic reticulum with iodine receptor associated with the transverse tubule. You now do a freeze fracture of this muscle. This is a transverse tubule with a specific structure. You see groups of dihydropyridine receptors in the area where the iodine receptor would be located, and there are no tetrads. So that the reconstruction would be as follows. You have an association of SR with the surface membrane. You have arrays of iodine receptor beautifully displayed, but the dihydropyridine receptor are not associated molecule to molecule in a stereospecific manner. So what happens, these are in close proximity to the iodine receptor, but they are not locked into a specific position. So if you assume that the activation from one to the other goes by an indirect means, and the most commonly accepted hypothesis is that calcium itself activates the opening of these channels, then this is an appropriate disposition. But you do not have the specific molecular contact which is necessary for the direct interaction which is supposed to happen in skeletal muscle. So we were interested in saying, well, when does this develop? So we looked at evolution very briefly. And if you look at so we knew that the invertebrates had no tetrads. We knew that the higher vertebrate skeletal muscle had tetrads. So we looked at the boundary. So we looked at the beginning of the chordates, the protochordata, and phloxus is a classic muscle that has been looked at by microscopy for a long time. And then we looked at some primitive fishes. So primitive fish, the lamprey and the hagfish are also classically known primitive fish, and the garfish is slightly less known. It is actually a bony fish, so relatively developed, but it's one of the very ancient bony fish. And then we knew about already reptilia, aves, and mammalia from other studies. So we did the freeze fracture, and just to make a long story short, if you look at the sites where the surface membrane is associated with the sarcoplasmic reticulum in all these muscles, you find that in amphioxus you see groups of particles belonging to the hydropyridine receptor, but they do not form tetrads. The hagfish, lamprey, and garfish do form tetrads, so that the transition occurs between the low chordates and the oily fish. So that's where the discovery of this specific interaction between the two molecules that allows them to interact in such a way that they don't need extracellular calcium entry occurs. Now, you know, if you think of it, does that give you an advantage? Well, you know, some people immediately say, oh, well, it makes it faster. No, it does not necessarily make it faster. The dragonfly muscle is super fast, and it has calcium-dependent EC coupling. It makes it metabolically more acceptable because every time that you allow calcium to come in from the outside, you then have to pump it back out. And that's against the relatively large concentration gradient. It's much better to pump it back in into the SR. So these muscles that have no tetrads and are calcium-dependent pay a very high metabolic debt for that. These muscles have a very tight sarcoplasmic reticulum, so the calcium gets cycled between the myofibrils and the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that requires less energy. So this is a discovery that allowed maybe That happened actually at the same time, I should say, when the dichotomy or the gene replication that allowed the differentiation of skeletal from cardiac myosin, so-called, then the differentiation to all sorts of different muscle myosins. So this is when the vertebrate developed. And this is just a sketch of that. So, but we can also look at the same set of questions using experimental approaches. And then actually, in the process of doing that, we got a few mild surprises, and I'll come to it, particularly as regard the phylogeny. And I should say that from here on, the work is all dependent on collaborations. I do electron microscopy. Lots of people do molecular biology. So I get the byproducts of the molecular biology and look at the electron microscope and define what the result is. And I say I keep them honest, because if I don't see a change, then the molecular biology hasn't worked out very well. So I try and be sure that I give credits to all the collaborators. Okay, well, sorry, I jumped. Okay, so the first set of experiments started with the so-called dysgenic muscle, which was available at Smith College in the hands of Gene Powell, a very generous scientist who then allowed lots of other laboratories to have it. Among them, actually, the major one was Kurt Beam, who eventually demonstrated that the problem with this mouse, which has a total block of excitation-contraction coupling, was in the lack of the alpha subunit of the dihydropyridine receptor, which is the main channel-forming subunit of this channel. And the mice die at birth because they don't breathe. The muscles are totally mobile, but cells can be cultured and structure can also be done before birth. And so the result, in short, of looking at the structure of the dysgenic mouse is that if you look at Friis fracture like here, and you have the tetrads in the surface membrane, which are overlying the ryanodine receptors of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the normal situation in the dysgenic muscle, you have the ryanodine receptor we know from thin sections, but we don't have the dihydropyridine receptor, so the membrane has assorted particles, but nothing special. So it's a muscle that has a component of ryanodine receptor. We know from thin section the ryanodine receptor is associated with the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it's in turn associated with the transverse tubule. So in thin section, the trial looks as usual, but it has no dihydropyridine receptor. Now you can take these and transfect the culture cells with all sorts of types of dihydropyridine receptor, including various chimeras. And here is a set of experiments that were started initially in Kurt Beam lab, were continued later by Manfred Gramner, first in Kurt Beam lab, and then later in collaboration with Bernard Fluke, and this Takekura and Paolini in my laboratories. We've done a lot of the morphology. And here is very briefly the results of a lot of experiments. So if you transfer to dysgenic muscle with skeletal type dihydropyridine receptor, you get back skeletal type EC coupling, you get back tetrads. If you transfer to the cardiac, you don't get skeletal type EC coupling and you don't get tetrads. So here the two go together, tetrads and skeletal type EC coupling. Okay? And the cardiac type of dihydropyridine receptor just does not make it. However, if you take a chimera in which a critical element, which is called the 2-3 loop, is skeletal, then you get back both skeletal EC coupling and tetrads. So there is a specific part of the dihydropyridine receptor, which is the one that's capable of interacting with the ryanodine receptor. And indeed, actually, you can have just a teeny little bit of it interacting, and that's enough. If you do the reverse of this, all skeletal, but this critical element is cardiac, you don't get EC coupling, you don't get tetras. But if you have even this little bit that's skeletal, you get tetras and EC coupling. So tetras and EC coupling go together, and there is a specific piece of the dihydropyridine receptor which is critical for this interaction. So that's all very fine. Then they went ahead and used the dihydropyridine receptor from a insect, the musca, the common housefly. And here there was a little surprise, because if you take the musca, so in the musca and the housefly, because it's an insect, you would not have skeletal type EC coupling normally, right? Yet the, and sure enough, the hydropyridine receptor, which has the musca critical loop, does not make an EC coupling, but it makes tetrads. So the component of the molecule that allows the two molecules to link mechanically to each other is not the same component of the molecule that allows them to talk to each other. Well, that's very logical. I mean, you would expect two different parts of the molecule to do these two different functions. So that works out very well. If you put the, back the critical piece skeletal, of course you make EC coupling, and the tetras are even better. So that's fine. The only thing that doesn't go very well with that is this. Why this does not make tetrads, whereas this one does, is the 2-3 loop from the musca better than the one from the cardiac. And so we think that probably the cardiac in itself might inhibit the formation of tetrads, and the musca may be neutral, and what makes the connection is not necessarily the connection that allows the production of tetrads. So the mechanical link that holds the two molecules in the appropriate position may not necessarily be the 2-3 loop. It could be other parts of the molecule with this acting as an inhibitory component. So it's more complicated than that, and you'll see in a moment that we actually indeed have some information that is the case. So we, if you look at the hydropyridine receptor, the alpha 1 subunit is what I was talking about a moment ago. There is a cytoplasmic beta subunit. There is an alpha 2 gamma subunit. It's actually expressed together, which with the alpha 2 being large but mostly extracellular. So I'm going to explore what beta subunit has to do with all this, and I'm going to give you some information on the alpha 2 subunit. So the beta subunit work was done in collaboration with the laboratories of Grabner and Fluke, which Schneider Circle, a very intelligent student doing most of the work, and myself and Valentina DiBiase and Felder doing the microscopy. And so here is the experiment involved a finding that was done in Grabner and Fluke laboratories, and that is that there is a mutation of the zebrafish, which was called relaxed. The zebrafish was immobile, basically. And that mutation seemed to be equivalent to the dysgenic mouse in the sense there was no EC coupling. So they went first looking for changes in the alpha-1 subunit of the dihydropyridine receptor, didn't find any, and after looking, found that the problem was with the beta subunit. So that if you look at the alpha-1 subunit, it's expressed in both, although the relaxed tend to express less. The alpha-2 gamma is expressed in both, even though a bit less. The beta is not expressed. So the beta, there is a null mutation, basically, for the beta subunit. The ryanodine receptor is in both, and beta and ryanodine receptor show that it's co-localized in the normal, but the beta is missing in the relaxed muscle. So we again, of course, did Friis fracture and found, somewhat to our surprise, that even though in both cases you have feet appropriately located, but if you look at the normal and you see your tetrads, you look at the relaxed muscle, there are no tetrads. So now the beta subunit seemed to be a very strong component in the formation of the tetrads, in allowing the specific mechanical link between the molecules. That was unexpected. It had been shown that the beta had to do something with this coupling, but you see again, the physiology was done without the morphology. So the physiology said there is no beta, there is no EC coupling. Well, they did not know that there was no EC coupling because the things didn't get together. If you don't get the two molecules to be linked to each other, they're not going to be able to talk to each other directly in the absence of calcium. So this was a very interesting result. But here we go a bit further. Recently, Grabner has started transfecting back with the beta subunit, and if you put back the beta 1A, which is a skeletal type. You rescue the turtles. It's not fantastic that there are turtles there. If you transfer back with the brain beta subunit, you do not get turtles, so that's not good enough. But interesting now, the beta from the insect seem to be able to allow the rescue of turtles. So somehow it looks like the dihydropyridine receptor from the insects already has the possibility of forming the specific link. But maybe the ionodine receptor is the one that had not yet evolved before the vertebrates come. So this is something that we need to look into a bit more, but it's some indication that this may be the case. Now, what does the alpha 2 delta subunit does? It's a very large subunit, and Fluker and Gramner had already shown that you take it away, you basically still have perfectly good EC coupling. But I was interested in looking at the structure for the following reason, that when you freeze fracture and you see a bump or a particle when the protein is, it does not really tell you all that much about what you're looking. You see an amorphous big bump. And I wanted to know, since alpha 1 and alpha 2 subunits have approximate equal molecular weight, which one of the two was the one that was contributing to the bump that I was seeing, because I want to locate the bump relative to the ionodine receptor. So Paul Allen, who is a magician of molecular biology, I sort of said, well, you know, get rid of the alpha 2 subunit. So I got rid of the alpha 2 subunit, produced some cells that have extremely, basically, zero expression. And so with collaboration with this laboratory, and also with Kurt Beam doing some of the physiology, and we looked at and Isaac Pesser doing some more physiology. I'll mention the physiology in a moment. We did the structure and the physiology. So the structure first. The structure says that in the presence or in the absence of the alpha 2 subunit, the tetrad is the same. And if you measure these distances between the particles, it comes, you know, there is some distortion during fracture, but even so, it comes absolutely so identical that I couldn't believe the data, even though I took the measurements myself personally on using blind images. So the tetrads is an alter. So now, from the structure point of view, what we know now is that that specific position is a specific position of the alpha 1 subunit, the channel position. And eventually, when people would finally solve this at the high molecular level, this would be an interesting bit of information to add. So that when we look at this, this is where the alpha subunit, the alpha 1 subunit sits relative to the dihydropyridine receptor. And, you know, one can do a lot of arguing about that. And think specifically how the two molecules are talking to each other. But it's a bit soon to get to anything more than this. From the structure, from the functional point of view, it's an interesting thing that even though EC coupling is not altered, a different type of interaction that Isaac Pesser has discovered, whereby when you depolarize, you eventually activate an extra calcium current that flows in, which is dependent on activation and does not have to do with the initial activation of the hydrophilic receptor. That one is blocked by the absence of the alpha 2 subunit. And so that, again, will be something that will be looked at in further detail later. So the alpha 2 subunit does not have to do directly with EC coupling, but it does have to do with some other interactions within those molecules. Okay, now a similar approach, but looking on the other side of the ionodine receptor, and we now are now taking advantage of a dyspeptic muscle, so a muscle that does not have feet because it does not express the ionodine receptor. This is a known mutation that was, in this particular case, produced in the laboratory of Paul Allen. So we have mice and or cells. He produced a cell line that was dyspeptic, and then we can do all sorts of experiments. So the first thing that you see, and I forgot to put the name of Feliciano Protasi, my ex-postdoc who is now back in Italy, who did some of this work. The first thing you see is that in the absence of the ionodine receptor, the dihydropyridine receptor still comes into clusters at the junctions, but it does not make tetrads. So we already were guessing that the tetrad disposition was due to a link between the two molecules. This is a direct demonstration of that. So by itself, the dihydropyridine receptor does not associate into tetrads. It has to be an interaction between it and the ryanodine receptor that produces a tetrad. Okay, so that's some bit of information. Now, here is something else that again, from the work of Kurt Beam, which is very important. He found the following, that if you look at the, let's look at these first three, at the calcium currents in skeletal muscle, you depolarize, you see a small calcium current, you see a calcium signal inside. Now you look at the dysplastic muscle. You don't see calcium signal inside, of course. There are no ryanodine receptor to release calcium, but you also don't see calcium current. And yet he can measure charge movement. He can measure the fact that the protein is there and is responding to the voltage. So this channel and the absence of that channel refuses to open. When you transfect again with ryanodine receptor type 1, but not when you transfect with other types of ryanodine receptor, the current comes back. So what he discovered was the fact that there are two types of interactions, the orthograde interaction whereby voltage sensing results in by the dihydropyridine receptor results in opening of the ryanodine receptor, and retrograde calcium enhancing whereby in the presence of this molecule, that molecule acts as a calcium channel, opens and allows calcium to. Now, I should say that, this particular demonstration, together with the morphology, the two bits of evidence that says that the hypothesis that the two molecules are really talking to each other is really quite strongly founded upon. So that you, with this demonstration, with the morphology, you can say, yes, it's extremely likely that that's exactly what happens. Those two molecules talk to each other. Okay. The other evidence, of course, is the fact that whenever, which I've already shown and I'll show some more, whenever there is calcium independency coupling, you always have tetrads. And so that specific position of the molecules, which is what allows them to talk to each other, is necessary for that type of interaction. And here is one of a series of several experiments that were done. And again, in Paul Allen's laboratory, Beam's laboratory doing the physiology, us doing the structure, and Claudio Perez producing all sorts of chimeras. This is a set of chimeras between two types of ryanodine receptor which are present in skeletal muscle. One is the type 1, is the one that I've been talking about so far, but also some muscles contain type 3. Type 3 by itself, when expressed in a dysgenic muscle, does not produce skeletal type EC coupling. So if you look at this thing, if you transfect the dysplastic cells with type 1 ryanodine receptor, you get skeletal EC coupling restoration complete. If you transfect with type 3, you get no skeletal type EC coupling restoration. And various chimeras are variously effective. And what you find out is that there is a piece here which is called the D2 region, which is present in skeletal and cardiac muscle, but not in type 3, which is absolutely essential. Without the D2 region, you don't get EC coupling. And in addition, there is a strengthening of that by central region of the molecule. Now, the important thing in correlating this is that the efficiency of restoring skeletal type EC coupling goes very well with the efficiency of restoring tetrads, which we obtain by looking at the pictures and seeing how many of the particles in each group is located into tetrads and how many seem to be random, and the efficiency of restoring the backwards going effect, which is a retrograde effect, which is measured as a calcium current. Now, there is a little bit of an effect of the type 3 ryanodine receptor. This is actually not zero. There is a bit of calcium current produced by type 3 alone, but overall there is the more you have a component that is good at making tetrads and is good at looking at good at making autograde coupling, it's also good at making retrograde coupling. So the three go together. So, and I'll finish up by jumping to a different part of the story, and that is the part that has to do with the calsequestrin, jointin, and triadin components. So, and actually here I'm going to really, really oversimplify, because functionally there's a lot of evidence that these three proteins not only are part of a macromolecular complex that holds them together, as demonstrated by biochemistry by Larry Jones, but also have a functional influence on the function of the ryanodine receptor. But I'll show evidence for the structural coupling in the complex. So we'll go back to the first picture. Remember this content of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and you see how it's a little bit more condensed, right, next to where the ryanodine receptors are. This is an abnormal muscle. Now, the next picture is going to be a bit more difficult to understand. This one. It's a deep etch image where you're looking, I fractured and then etched, so you can look inside the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All these little bumps here represent that loose calsequestrin component. But look at when you get here next to the membrane, there are these little lines connecting them, sort of connecting them together. Now, this was taken long before it was shown that there are actually two proteins called jointin and triadin, which have it associate biochemically both with the ryanodine receptor and with the calsequestrin. And in collaboration with Larry Jones, who discovered these associations, we then looked at what happens when you overexpress these proteins in cardiac muscle, and that is happens to be very revealing. So here is cardiac muscle in a normal condition, and typically, as I showed earlier, the sarcoplasmic reticulum that forms a junction is this very flat, thin, pancake-like vesicle, which is associated with this profile, which is a transverse tubule. And inside that little pancake vesicle, there is some density which is somewhat connected into periodic little densities. That is the calsequestrin. Now, when you overexpress calsequestrin, then this specific flattened shape changes, and the association is less specific. The calsequestrin just fills the whole vesicle up with this loose network, but it's a network. The protein is not soluble under these conditions, otherwise I would not see it like that. So this is what happens if you overexpress the calsequestrin. If you overexpress instead of calsequestrin, you overexpress jointin, then you have exactly the opposite effect. These vesicles become slightly tighter and slightly more dense. Now, if I measure these diameter here, even though it may appear the same to you, it's actually significantly smaller. So it becomes tight, it becomes dense, and this periodicity is more obvious. Now, if you overexpress both at the same time, the calsequestrin tends to overpower the effect of jointin, but you now see right next to the membrane a little bit of density. Okay? It's not that visible to your eye, but I played a game with my student. I looked at the microscope without knowing what I was looking at, and I always guessed the appropriate composition by looking and seeing whether I had this density there. But let me show you a more obvious example. If you overexpress triadin alone, you have the same effect. It goes from here to a more dense situation. If you overexpress calsequestrin, jointin, and triadin at the same time, now the effect of making this dense disposition next to the membrane is more obvious, and here it is. So basically what we have is a situation where triadin and or jointin have the same effect of attaching or associating the calsequestrin to the membrane. Now, the rest of the calcium question is associated with itself because it is known the calcium question tend to self-polymerize in the presence of the small amount of calcium inside the endoplasmic, the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in order to maintain its position in the triad, it has to be associated with this membrane, and that's associations produced by triadin and orjontin. So let me demonstrate this further with the opposite experiment. Again, I talked to Paul Allen, and Paul Allen produced a triadin normouse in his laboratory with Sheila Shane and Claudio Perez. And I looked at it, and the triadin normouse, interestingly enough, walks around, reproduces, and does everything perfectly fine. There's not a very major change. But there are some subtle changes in its entry of calcium, and also there is a subtle structural change. If you look with the antibodies for the various protein, angiotensin receptor, jontin, and calsequestrin, you don't see much difference in the disposition of these molecules at the junction. So the molecules are all present. If you look structurally, you start seeing two things. One I cannot explain, and one makes sense. The one that I cannot explain is why all of a sudden you have a change in the disposition of the triads. Normally, in this orientation of the section, the triad in a mouse muscle looks like this because the T-tubule is coming in and out of the plane of the screen, and so it's cut across. But here, a situation where the T-tubule is going longitudinally. Here's another one. Here's another one. Here's another one. Now, the longitudinal disposition of T-tubules is an intermediary stage during development. And so this could be the means that these fibers are regenerating, degenerating, regenerating a bit more frequently than normal, but I don't have much evidence for that, so I'm not entirely sure what this means. But the other bit of evidence is demonstrative. And here's what we find, that we look at in detail, here's a triad and here's another triad, and usually calsequestrin is only at the triad, but look here, there's a calsequestrin coming all along the rest of the endoplasmic reticulum, coming longitudinally, as if it was being held less tightly at the junction. So this would be an interpretation of what you're seeing, but normally calsequestrin is held within the triad by the connection of jontin and triadin with the membrane, and in the absence of triadin, some of it breaks loose and moves longitudinally in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So again, it's a very direct graphic demonstration of what has been proposed to be on the basis of biochemical data. Now, here's a surprise. Björn Norman, when he was here in Carl Pfeiffer lab, they produced a mouse that has a null mutation for the cardiac-specific type of calsequestrin. And I must say the felcanoprotazi total independent has a similar study using a null mutation for the skeletal type of calsequestrin. But here is a heart that has no calsequestrin. Now, calsequestrin is the molecule that binds calcium inside the reticulum and allows the reticulum to hold a higher total concentration of calcium without raising the free concentration too high, because if you raise it too high, then the pump gets inhibited. So it is always thought that it's a protein that's absolutely essential to allow the sarcoplasmic reticulum to hold a large level of calcium, so when you activate, you have a lot of calcium to release. And here is a heart that has no calsequestrin, and it seems to function normally. Okay, so first look at the structure for a moment. Here are normal dyads in the cardiac muscle of a normal heart, and as I said before, it's this tight vesicle with this periodically disposed calsequestrin. If you look at the null mutation, the vesicle is more variable in diameter, and it also is apparently empty. Well, all nice and good. So calsequestrin was this molecule that we were seeing. And so the heart seems to be normal. However, when exposed to catecholamines, they develop arrhythmias due to premature calcium release. So the calsequestrin does have some effect on regulating the function of the of the Ramana Dhyanasati. And I said there are lots of studies indicating that, and I can't get into that in detail. From the Stocha point of view, here is a lack of casta question which produces the effect that one would expect. But actually, we also have an answer to the question of how comes the heart can behave normally, because in fact, the heart has increased its sarcoplasmic reticulum volume and surface area. So that if you look at the thin section, I noticed it first in thin section, but this seemed to be a little bit too much SI for a cardiac muscle, although sometimes you see a fair amount. So we did a complete morphometric analysis, and what we found is that if you look, the mitochondrial volume is essentially unchanged, but the SI volume versus to the total volume of cell, excluding nuclear area, is about 50% larger, and that's significant. It's also larger when you take away the mitochondrial volume, so it's the cytoplasmic volume, and the surface area is also equally increased. So there is a compensation. This is enough to compensate for the lack of calcequestin, apparently, as far as the heart is not challenged with the catecholamines. And that is not, in a sense, unreasonable, because calcequestin is not in very large amounts in cardiac muscle. So anyway, this is the sort of things that I'm working on right now, just trying to unravel when a mutation happens and a certain functional changes occur, how does it relate to what structurally happens to the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and helps us to actually further understand the relationship between the molecules that compose it. Thank you.
Clara, have you had a chance to look at that mouse heart after it's been treated with catecholamines, and what do you see if you have looked at it?
Actually, I have not. Bjorn was doing all these experiments. So I have not. I haven't thought about it. It might be interesting, actually. I'll ask to have some hearts, yeah.
I just want to add that Clara has information about the feet, but I think informally many of the people in the field call those are Clara's feet. So.
Sometimes they were called Clara's and Clay's feet, but.
So, any more questions?
Right. I was just too much to show and did not. You caught something that's in the slide. Indeed, the position of the tetrads, there's still one tetrad over the other foot, but the relative position of tetrad and feet is slightly different. From bony fissures up, it's all the same, but before that, it's a little bit different. It's right, yeah.
I'm just a little bit interested in what about the calcequestrin neural hearts. What about the calcium buffer system in SR lumina? And have you ever tried to measure SR calcium lumina calcium content in those hearts? And another second question is any way you're thinking of using AFM, the atomic force microscopy, to study the random receptor? Is that appropriate way to do it?
Yeah, so it's the first question. I never done any of those measurements myself. The best measurements that were done by Avril and Andrew Somlyo in the early 1980s. measuring the calcium content of the sarcoplasmic reticulum in situ. On the isolated SR, it's been done a lot of times, of course. When functional experiments were done, and this were the experiments were done in the 60s, to measure how much calcium the SR could take up, it was very clearly shown that the pump could pump up to a certain level, and then when the concentration reached something like 10 to the minus 4, the pump got inhibited. Now, when you have calsequestrin, you can get up to about, I think, several millimoles concentration total because of the calsequestrin content. So those are all data that are known in the literature. Now, the ryanodine receptor could be studied by atomic force microscopy, but I think that actually the single particle analysis that's been done, the ones that I was quoting, has a higher probability of obtaining the higher resolution images, the problem being that the molecule, the cytoplasmic domain of the molecule, is very highly hydrated. And if you look at it by atomic force, you're probably going to deform it too much in the process of obtaining the images, I would suspect.
My question is as follows. You know, the essential difference between cardiac alpha-1C channel and skeletal muscle is the tendency of the cardiac channel to form large clusters. You know, photobleaching experiments showed that the cluster size is approximately 40 molecules per plaque that you see.
Yes.
Now, this property depends on calmodulin calcium sensing machinery that resides in the carboxyl tail of alpha-1C channel. If you mutate this part, or if you introduce any mutation of a cardiac channel that eliminates calcium-induced inactivation and slow mechanism of inactivation, these clusters disappear.
Yeah.
And the channel is distributed, you know, evenly over the plasma membrane in the recombinant system. Now, my question is, have you looked at this similar property of skeletal muscle channel, because it contains also calmodulin IQ motif?
You mean the DHPR?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I've not looked at it in conditions where it might get dispersed. It seems to be always, The skeletal DHPR can form very large clusters. For example, if you take a cultured BC3H1 cell, which is a cell derived from skeletal muscle, you can get enormous plaques of DHPRs, skeletal type. So,
yeah, this was an observation by Fluker, as I remember.
Yes.
How about development? In development, how this skeletal muscle ordered architecture is assembled?
Well, I actually, in that same paper with Fluker, we were asking ourselves the question of whether that alternate disposition of tetrads is there to start with. So we looked at groups of DHPRs that contain few channels, and we asked ourselves, are those few channels disposed presumably on every ryanodine receptor or already on alternate? And they seem to be disposed on alternate ryanodine receptor to start with. So I still don't know why, but that's the way it came. So my impression is that in the formation of, from what I've seen from, you know, looking at development, cardiac and skeletal and all that, when you develop one of these junctions, the first thing that you do, you dock the sarcoplasmic reticulum and the gentophilin molecules of Takeshima, probably the molecules involved. So you dock the two membranes together, then the others flow in and associate with each other. And the ryanodine receptor has self-assembly properties, so whenever you have a ryanodine receptor by itself, the absence of the dihydropyrine receptor makes those specific arrays, but the dihydropyrine receptor needs to be associated with the ryanodine receptor to make the tetrads. So that's all I know, but it seems to me that there is something that allows the two membranes to dock together, and that may be the same protein allows the other two proteins to come in and stick and be trapped into the junction. And once they're trapped in the junction, they'll interact with each other. And they will be. Because they get, mind you, they get trapped in the dysgenic muscle. The Ryanair receptor is in the junction without need for the dihydropyrine receptor. In the dyspeptic muscle, the dihydropyrine receptor is in the junction without need of the Ryanair receptor. So the two can get there independently of each other. Does that answer? Yeah.
Well, I think, let's thank Dr. Francie Armstrong. And there's a reception at the end of this hall.